The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Nina Schaefer. I am a poet and the founder of the Unexpected Poetry Project here in Philadelphia. As you saw in the brief video that just aired, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guided learning, and inspiring curiosity, from its award-winning author event series to its thought-provoking programs like the Monday Poets Series. Many of the library's most beloved programs and services are made possible only with the help of private support. A gift of whatever amount you are able helps the Free Library transform lives. Please make your gift online at freelibrary.org/support. You can also sign up online for an instant virtual library card, which gives you access to our digital offerings, including ebooks and streaming movies. If you currently do not have a library card, you can sign up right now or while waiting in line to have your book signed. It is that quick a process. It is now my pleasure to introduce award-winning author Helen MacDonald. A naturalist by trade, she came to international prominence for H is for Hawk, her beautiful, riveting tale of adopting and raising a goshawk, and which won the 2014 Samuel Johnson Prize for nonfiction. She had a self-described obsession with hawks as a child and had formerly been a professional falconer. But during this experience, in the wake of her father's death, she describes at times actually becoming more hawk, less human. But with a book that landed on more than 25 best books of the year lists, she may find readers arguing that her stunning story touched so many precisely because of its humanity. In her collection, Shaler's Fish, she celebrates the natural world and its inward effects on our consciousness through a joyous book of verse. Publishers Weekly praises, devoted readers of H's for Hawk will find MacDonald's gift for stunning language, patient curiosity, and expansive wisdom on full display in her poems. We are so pleased to have her here with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Helen MacDonald to the Free Library.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming, people. I'm so English. That was such a lovely introduction, and I was kind of squirming with sort of embarrassment behind the curtain. That was lovely. Thank you. It's great to be here. I haven't been to the city for about 15 years, so it's just fab to be back. One of the things I love about this is wherever this book has been published, in whichever language, they've used the same cover, except in Italy, where they've replaced it with a picture of a buxom young lady with a hawk, which I thought was hilarious. Really amused me. It's great. So what I'm going to do is talk through the book and give little readings. I'm not going to talk so much about one big strand of the book, which is the life of T.H. White, the writer who many of you may have come across through his extraordinary retellings of the Arthurian legend, the Once and Future King and the Sword in the Stone, part of that trilogy, quadrilogy. He was a very interesting and very sad man, brought up in British India, sent to prep school where he was beaten pretty much every day, had really violent childhood with very unpleasant and unhappy parents, and it broke him. And he ran away to train a goshawk when he was trying to be a school teacher. He couldn't cope with trying to be normal anymore. He was gay too, not a brilliant thing to be if you were born in 1906. And he made a terrible job of this, trying to train this hawk. And he wrote this book called The Goshawk about it. And I weave the story of that book in with mine. Not, as I hasten to add, to say I can train hawks and he can't, but to talk about how both of us made the same mistake, which was we saw these birds as mirrors of ourselves, mirrors of our own needs. And that's a big mistake we all make all the time unconsciously when we look at the natural world. So it's kind of about that. So I guess the book starts really in 2007, actually 2 days ago in 2007, on the 20th, I got this phone call from my mum, and she just said, I had a phone call from St. Thomas's Hospital, and I knew instantly that my father had died, and my legs broke, buckled, I fell to the ground. I never realised why people said, sit down if you've got bad news, and it was horrible. We didn't even know he was ill. He had a massive heart attack, and the world fell apart, really, and the weird things started to happen. The world became very strange, and then this really strange thing happened. I started dreaming of goshawks every single night, and one in particular. I used to work at a falconry centre in England, and we had a wild one brought in once that had hit a tree while she was hunting. They go quite berserk when they're hunting. They kind of lock on. And if there's a tree or a fence in the way, they tend to just get sort of sieved out by it. And this one got knocked out. This nice lady picked it up, put it in a box, brought it to us because she was terrified of it. So we had a look at this bird. And I'll just read this little bit from the book about what that was like. We congregated in a darkened room with the box on the table, and the boss reached her gloved left hand inside. A short scuffle, and then out into the gloom, her grey crest raised and her barred chest feathers puffed up into a meringue of aggression in fear, came a huge old female goshawk. Old because her feet were gnarled and dusty, her eyes a deep fiery orange, and she was beautiful. Beautiful like a granite cliff or a thundercloud. She completely filled the room. She had a massive back of sun-bleached grey feathers, was as muscled as a pit bull and intimidating as hell, even to staff who spent their days tending eagles. So wild and spooky and reptilian. So we checked over to make sure she had no broken bones, and we checked her eyes by putting a finger in front of each eye in turn, and she went snap, snap. One of the things that will happen in this talk is when I'm talking about hawks, I quite often do the movements. It's really embarrassing and unconscious, so I'll start flapping my arms later and you can just laugh at me. But then she locked her eyes right on mine down her curved black beak, black pupils fixed, and it right then occurred to me that this goshawk was bigger than me and more important. And much, much older, a dinosaur pulled from the Forest of Dean. There was a distinct prehistoric scent to her feathers. It caught in my nose, peppery and rusty as storm rain. Nothing was wrong with her at all. We took her outside and let her go, and she opened her wings and in a second was gone. She disappeared over a hedge, slantwise into nothing. It was as if she'd found a rent in the damp Gloucestershire air and slipped through it. That was the moment I kept replaying over and over. That was the moment that the hawk became inevitable. I was just thinking about how to talk about this next bit here. My niece is 12. She's a lovely, lovely, lovely person. And at the moment, she's obsessed with Minecraft and Taylor Swift. Both excellent things to be obsessed with when you're 12. I was obsessed with falconry and birds of prey, much less of a normal thing to be obsessed with. So my friends would have sort of photographs of rock stars on their walls, and I'd have pictures of kestrels. And this is a very open book emotionally. I tried when I started to write it to be more reserved and British, but it didn't work. I had to really lay it all out on the table. But of all the things I confess in this book, the one that I still feel a bit awful about was that when I was small, I used to try and sleep with my arms behind my back like wings because I wanted to be like a hawk. That just still seems deeply embarrassing to me. But I wanted to be a falcon. I wanted to be a bird. I wanted to be as close to birds of prey as possible. And I told my parents this, and they were so supportive. I think only twice did my mother say, "Are you sure you wouldn't rather be a lawyer?" You know, they were really supportive. I got my first kestrel when I was 12. She used to sleep on my bedroom bookcase with newspaper on the floor to catch the mess. They were really lovely parents. I grew up, I flew peregrine falcons, ger falcons, saker falcons, merlins. I even flew some eagles for a while. There was one bird I never wanted to touch, and I think you know what it is. It's a goshawk, and there were lots of reasons for that. The main reason was that in the cultures of falconry, they have this kind of reputation as being avian Christopher Walkens. They're just these deeply... I mean, obviously, the characters he plays, not him. They're these deeply psychopathic, highly strung, nervous killers. And I just didn't really want to know about that. And also, they tended to be quite macho birds. You know, guys would fly them. They'd consider them to be something like feathered shotguns. You know, they'd come back with bags full of rabbits for the family to eat, much to the consternation of their wives, normally. And I never wanted one. But then they were all I could think about after my father died. And I went and bought one off the internet. That sounds worse than it was. All the birds of prey used in Britain, as opposed to America, where there's a much more stringent licensing system here for falconers. In Britain, they're all captive bred. You can't take wild birds. And so I drove up to Scotland to a quayside in Stranraer. I'm sure, have any of you been to Stranraer? You have! Oh my goodness. It's almost entirely unlike Philadelphia, isn't it, really? And I was pacing up and down, waiting for this chap to come over on the ferry from Northern Ireland where he had bred these goshawks. And it was like a drugs deal. I was smoking a cigarette. I had a can of Red Bull. I had £800 in my pocket. It felt very dodgy indeed. And in fact, when I drove away with the hawk in the car, I looked back to discover he was surrounded by armed policemen who wanted to know what the hell he'd been doing. I kept driving. I feel really bad about that now. But he was fine. All the paperwork was up, was fine. And this is where I saw my first sight of my hawk, who, you know, became one of the most important, still is one of the most important, even though she's not around anymore, things that has ever happened to me. And I'm just going to read this little bit here about what it was like to see her for the first time. And I don't normally talk about what I'm trying to achieve in a passage of writing. I always find that kind of a bit awkward. But this bit here, I'm trying to describe what she was like. It gets quite purple prosy. And I fail over and over and over again. And by the end of it, I'm trying to mimic what happens in the book in its entirety, which is that it starts off being me looking at the world through my eyes, and by the end, I'm looking at the world through hers. So I'll just read this bit. Another hinge untied, concentration, infinite caution, daylight irrigating the box, scratching talons, another thump and another thump. The air turned syrupy and slow, flecked with dust, the last few seconds before a battle. And with the last bow pulled free, he reached inside, and amidst a whirring, chaotic clatter of wings and feet and talons, and a high-pitched twittering, and it's all happening at once, the man pulled an enormous hawk out of the box. And in a strange coincidence of world and deed, a great flood of sunlight drenches us, and everything is brilliance and fury. The hawk's wings barred and beating, the sharp fingers of her dark-tipped primaries cutting the air, her feathers raised like the scattered quills of a fretful porpentine. I stole that from Hamlet. Two enormous eyes. My heart jumps sideways. She's a conjuring trick, a reptile, a fallen angel, a griffin from the pages of an illuminated bestiary, something bright and distant like gold falling through water. A broken marionette of wings, legs, and light splashed feathers. She's wearing jesses, and the man holds them. And for one awful long moment, she's hanging head downward, wings open like a turkey in a butcher's shop. Only her head is turned right way up. And she is seeing more than she has ever seen before in her whole short life. Her world was an aviary, no larger than a living room. And then it was a box. But now it is this, and she can see everything. So... yeah, I had a goshawk. I brought her home and then became the great excuse. The great thing that this goshawk let me do initially was to distract myself utterly from the fact of my father's death, both, you know, intellectually and emotionally. How do you train a hawk? Well, you can't train a hawk by punishing it, ever. You can't raise your voice to it. I mean, obviously training any animal like that or behaving like that with people is bad. But hawks are solitary animals. They don't understand social kind of punishment at all, and they don't like, obviously, physical punishment. You do it all through gifts of food. This works with people too. Raw steak, not so well. I don't know. Some people I know might. So you sit with a hawk in a darkened room, and you enter these very strange meditative states, and you will the hawk to not see you at all and just look at the food and eat. And slowly as the days go by in these darkened rooms, you begin to build this extraordinary trust with this wild bird. And eventually the bird will jump to your fist for food and then fly across the room. And it's an amazing kind of moment when the bird decides that you're something to come towards rather than be frightened of. I'd lock the doors, I'd pull the phone out. This shows how long ago it was. I pulled the phone cord out of the wall. I was a hermit. But then this thing happened where you have to take your hawk outside to get it used to the sort of everyday world. It's called carriage. And in fact, the actual taming of a hawk is called manning. Let no one ever think there's no gender issues in falconry. So if any of you have been to Cambridge, you'll know it's quite an eccentric place. But there are limits. And walking around with a bloody great hawk on your fist does lead to some issues. Quite often, small boys would run past me and shout, "Harry Potter!" And this made me furious. I'm like, it's not an owl, it's a goshawk, obviously. And I remember a couple of young mums with their children whispering to their child, you know, sotto voce, but I could hear them, "Don't go near the hawk lady." So I think I was quite a frightening figure, you know. But people did talk to me. Now, one of the things I talk about in the book is that the people that talked to me tended to be outsiders. They tended to be homeless people, people who were slightly drunk, would come out the pub, foreign students, tourists, teenage goths absolutely adored her. They used to sort of stand around and wonder at her. And I thought this was really interesting. I was already moving away from the world of normality into this other space, and I was very happy to be in that other place. I didn't want to be my normal old self anymore. And then came this very strange day where I was walking with her and finding the city a very strange and odd place. I'll just read this bit out, actually. This is the bit where initially I'd be taking her out and she'd been quite scared of dogs, and then a small dog went past, and that became very fascinating for another reason to her. She got in. Cars and buses rattle fumily past, and when the food is gone, she stands staring at the strange world around her. So do I. I've been with the hawk so long, just her and me, that I'm seeing my city through her eyes. She watches a woman throwing a ball to a dog, and I watch too. I'm as baffled by what she's doing as the hawk is. I stare at traffic lights before I remember what they are. The bicycles I see are spinning mysteries of glittering metal, and the buses going past are walls with wheels. What's salient to the hawk in the city is not what is salient to man. The things she sees are uninteresting to her, irrelevant, until there's a clatter of wings. We both look up. There's a pigeon, a wood pigeon, sailing down to roost in a lime tree above us. Time slows, the air thickens, and the hawk is transformed. It's as if all her weapon systems were suddenly engaged. Red crosshairs. She stands on her toes. I'm doing it. She stands on her toes and cranes her neck. This flight path, this thing, she thinks. This is fascinating. Some part of my hawk's young brain has just worked something out, and it has everything to do with death. I hadn't really thought this through, had I? I mean, what I was doing was trying to escape my father's death, and what I had was this bird that was hyper-predatory and wanted to murder everything it saw. Yeah. Now, I knew that, I mean, that's not why I wanted a bird of prey. People sort of said, you know, did you get a hawk because you wanted to murder things to kind of... And I said, no, I wanted a hawk because it seemed the most... To me, at that point, the most vital living thing. It was this solitary, self-possessed creature that lived in this present, that was an extraordinary animal to be near. But I knew I'd let her hunt, because that's what hawks do. And I say in the book that having a goshawk and saying it's not allowed to hunt is a bit like having kids and saying, oh, it's nice to have kids, but I don't let them play. I mean, it's what they're made of. So I went out with a hawk and I let her chase things. And I hadn't expected quite how astonishing that would be. I'm not a bloodthirsty person. My friends laugh at me because I rescue spiders from the bath, you know, and take them outside and stuff. But there I was, running after a hawk. She was like a piece of cloud scratched out of the kind of sky and sort of pushed across these frosty hillsides. It was extraordinarily transporting, and it completely changed the way I looked at the landscape. You know, when I look at a landscape, normally, I'm sure if any of you go out and look at things, you sort of think, well, that's a tree, there's a house, there's a horse, you know. Everything has names. And there are, you can kind of rank things in order of interest and importance. You know, maybe the house is more interesting than that small flower down there. When I was out with the hawk, I had this weird new phenomenal version of the world where nothing was more important than anything else, and all the names disappeared, and the world became extremely complicated. I remember looking at a field of new wheat and spending minutes just staring at all the tiny shoots. It was really strange as an imaginative act. And it was extraordinary. And Mabel and I went out hawking. Oh, I should say why I call her Mabel, actually. There's a tradition in falconry that if you give a hawk a name like Slayer or Killer, it will sit on a fence post and squeak at you. If you give them cutesy names, they tend to be proficient hunters. So I have a friend with a goshawk called Bunty, and I have another friend with a goshawk called Baby Doll, but even he's embarrassed about that and calls her BD. Mabel meant lovable in Latin, lovable or dear, and I thought there was something about that that's quite poignant in retrospect, that even though I wanted to cut myself off from everything warm in the world and live with this remote, beautiful wild creature, I still kind of, there was sort of a sort of need for love somewhere in that equation. Yeah, but things started to go quite badly wrong. There were quite a lot of times I used to wake up in the morning and discover my pillow was soaking wet, and I'd been crying all night without knowing why. And I remember thinking quite, I must have an allergy. It's something not right. And I began to become really, really odd. There were times when I remember the mailman would come and knock on the door, and I'd find myself hiding behind the chairs in my front room. I didn't eat, or I ate a lot. I mean, I became basically a goshawk in my mind. I became all the things that people thought goshawks were. I was kind of like that. I was frightened of people. And I was a mess. I just pushed all that grief away and become this very inhuman creature in my imagination. And I try in the book to explain what that was like and what was going on. And oddly enough, you know, there are lots of ways you could think about this if you go to Freud or you go to Klein or attachment theory or look at all sorts of really brilliant sort of psychoanalytic stuff. But the one that really rang true for me was a paper by an extraordinary anthropologist called Rane Vilislev. And he went to Siberia and spent a lot of time with the Yukaghe people there, who are hunters. And they do this amazing thing when they hunt caribou. They dress up in caribou skins, and they do more. They take into themselves some part of the caribou's soul as they do so. It's a willed assumption of caribou-ness. And then they will go out, and the caribou will see them, and they will see that they are family, and the caribou will come towards them. This doesn't end well for those caribou, obviously, but it's a really interesting, because the Yukaghe was saying that you mustn't do it too much. If you do it too much, you imperil who you are, you imperil your human soul. And there's an amazing story about one hunter chasing, tracking a huge herd of these things for a long time, thinking about nothing but them, and then finding himself in a village full of people he didn't know who gave him lichen to eat. It's a bit of a giveaway, I think. And then he started to forget things. He remembered he had a wife, but he couldn't remember her name. That's really, really heartbreaking. And then he realized that they weren't people, they were caribou. And he ran home terrified. He nearly lost who he was. And it was kind of like that. You know, I basically had imagined myself into the mind of this hawk as a way of not being a grieving person anymore. And it wasn't until I went to my father's memorial service and sat in front of, well, people like you only wearing black, and it was a church rather than that I realized I'd made this terrible mistake. And the mistake was a very simple one. You know, when we grow up, we're taught this lesson by all the stories and books we read that when you're broken, the thing that can heal you is nature. You can go out into the world, and this is green space full of infinite solace and renewal. This is obviously true to a certain extent, but typically for me, I'd gone way too far. And I'd got completely lost, and I sunk into what I now recognize was a very deep depression, only a very strange one for me, because I didn't feel sad. I just felt like a hawk. So what did I do? Well, I went to the doctors. You know, what do you do? And a lot of people have sort of said, you know, you're very open about this. You know, you talked about going to the doctors and getting on antidepressants. And I'm like, well, that's what happened, you know. So I'm just going to read you this little bit about what it was like to go to the doctors. That sounds so boring, doesn't it? It was a very weird experience. I drive to the surgery with no hope of rescue, but I can't think of anything else to do. The doctor is a man I've not seen before. He's small and dark hair with a neat beard, red braces, and a crumpled cotton shirt. Dr. Stewart, inside information there. He sits behind a wooden desk. Hello, he says. Take a seat. I sit on a chair. I look at the desk. It is oak. I think of winter trees. What seems to be the trouble, he says. I say I think I might be depressed, that some things have happened over the last few months, that my father died. I'm sorry, he says. And then I tell him I've got no job anymore and no money coming in and no house either. It doesn't sound convincing. Notice I didn't mention the hawk at all. Yeah, I had a woman in an audience once who sort of stood up and said, I'm a psychoanalyst. Why didn't you mention the hawk? I didn't think about that. I think at that point, I just assumed we were the same thing. I didn't need to really call her to attention. And then I start telling him more and more and more, and then I start watching his eyebrows, and sometimes they're very, 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 very frowning, but mostly they're really high on his face. I get this multiple choice questionnaire about mood. This is actually quite funny in retrospect. One of the questions was, do you feel that you take less care of your personal appearance than formerly? And I remember sitting there and looking at myself. I hadn't washed my hair for a month. I was covered in mud. There was rabbit blood on my trousers. I was like, there were holes, like thorn holes in my sweaters. And I remember thinking, I don't know. Do I? Have I? And again, you know, that very much part of what depression does to you, you know, mental health issues do to you. So I started to take, you know, the antidepressants. I made a real effort to see my friends, and I began to crawl back into the world that I'd left behind. And thank goodness for that. My friends mostly forgave me. Well, they all forgave me eventually for abandoning them. And my family, to bless them. But the world has changed. I mean, the hawk taught me an awful lot. The hawk taught me big lessons. I mean, this is not a book that is like, you know, I was really sad and then I got a cat and then everything was fine. It's not like that. This bird took me on a trip to pretty much the underworld and back, you know, on her wings. And when I came back from that, what became really apparent to me that was that the great joy of that relationship between the hawk and a person, between me and Mabel, wasn't just that we'd sit and watch TV at night, you know. Mike Goshawk's watched more programs about antiques auctions and moving house than any goshawk in the history of the world. It wasn't just that we would play. I'd scrunched up paper balls and throw them to her and she'd catch them in her beak and throw them back, you know. It wasn't just that she was this wild thing that would take me into these incredible open wild spaces in my mind and in reality. It was that she wasn't me. You know, I saw her as a mirror of my own grief and I used her in that way, and that was a mistake. And the great thing was that Mabel was nothing like me. She's a bird, right? And yet we shared this life. Every time she flew free, she could fly away and she chose to come back. And we, you know, we were buddies as much as a bird and a person can be. And it taught me really, I guess, to not only understand that life is short and we're not here very long. It's kind of trite, but true. I didn't really think about it until then. But that we should love difference from us. You know, when I was small, I thought everyone was like me. Thank God they're not. But yeah, so, you know, all hail Mabel, who taught me to love things that are not me. And I'm going to end there. Thank you very much.
Fantastic.
So we'll take with the
some questions. If you raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you. Who would like to start us off?
I had a 5-year-old boy once in the audience. I don't quite know what he was doing there. Who stood up on a chair to ask his question. And he said, what was the biggest thing Mabel ever murdered? It's quite disconcerting. And I said, a big rabbit. And he was so disappointed with me. He thought I would say, like, a horse or something. And he actually ostentatiously ignored me outside because he was so... Sorry.
He's not here tonight. At least I don't see him. So who would like to start us off?
I really enjoyed your book. I've learned much more about birds than I ever knew.
Thank you.
I've never been obsessed with falcons. But what happened to Mabel?
Yeah, good question. So I flew Mabel in a much less intense and much more cheerful manner for many more years. And at the end of the book, if you read it, you'll know that I put her into an aviary so she can stuff her face with delicious food and grow a lovely set of new feathers. And I have a rest. And then all the books say that when you put a goshawk into an aviary and leave it alone, because they love being on their own, they're not really bothered being on their own, it will forget you completely. And then you'll have to start again from scratch the next when you pick her up in the autumn. And at the end of the book, one of the great sort of moments of understanding and sort of realization and revelation was that that was okay, that she wouldn't remember me and that, you know, that things, you know, things go. Of course, when I went back to pick her up, she was like, hi, Helen. How are you? You know, she completely remembered me. You know, I got back and she was, you know, playing with bits of paper and I was like, oh, the books were wrong, you know. She was frightened of other people, though I had to start that again. So I flew her, yeah, for a few more years, and then something happened. I basically ran out of money, and I had to go back and live with my mother for a while. Bless her for letting me do that. My mother lives in the middle of some of the most expensive shooting, sporting country in Britain. And for some reason, I wasn't really able to get any land to fly her on, because people wanted to shoot the pheasants, not have someone poach them with a goshawk. So I lent her to a very good falconer friend of mine up near Liverpool, who flew her for a year. And I wanted to get her, obviously, to back as soon as possible. But just before I could do that, she died very suddenly of a fungal infection called aspergillosis, which kills a lot of wild hawks. It kills very quickly. It's almost untreatable. And I wept buckets. I still miss her to bits. And I have a vase full of her molted feathers on my desk, which I bury my nose in sometimes and sort of remember what she smelled like. That sounds a bit weird, but I miss her. She was an extraordinary, extraordinary bird.
How old was she when she died?
She was only six, you know, and in the wild, you know, I mean, I have falconer friends who are flying 20-year-old goshawks, you know. But again, I guess, you know, sometimes that's what happens. I was still very sad that she's not here.
How did you grieve differently about her death than your father's?
Oh, good question. Well, A, she was a bird. I mean, you know, not to be blunt about it, but, you know, she was a bird. And she wasn't my dad. I mean, that's obviously trite. But I guess she taught me those lessons, you know, when she was hunting. And it was an incredibly difficult experience to watch. You know, when she grabbed rabbits or pheasants, you know, in the wild, when they immobilize an animal, they just start eating. They don't, you know, there's no reason for them to kind of, you know, cleanly dispatch their prey. So I had to run in and kill these things so they wouldn't suffer. And I, you know, that slow dawning realization that everything in the world is desperate to live, and but the borders between life and death are incredibly narrow. And I guess I just sort of reconciled to the fact that, you know, it happens. And I'd never thought about death before. I mean, we don't think about it. It happens behind walls now. We don't see it anymore. And I cried a lot.
I just think it was one of the most beautiful books I've ever read.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
I'm a horseback rider, and I know at one point you said that they're not like dogs and not like horses, but I found the way you described the way your perceptions changed and you began to see the world through her eyes is so much true. To when you're training a green horse.
Absolutely.
You look and you were afraid, oh, here comes somebody, she's going to be afraid of that. And it just, I wanted to ask you how much you felt she healed you in addition, how much she healed you.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting points. You see, I told you the questions are always brilliant, right? Two things. So the first thing is this notion of empathy in animal training. Anyone here who has any experience training animals knows that you have to try to see through their eyes, but it's much more than that. Eventually, you sort of viscerally become them, and you can respond. You know how they're going to feel. This is a really old thing that we can do, and it's very powerful. But because I was so broken and didn't want to be me anymore, it was an extraordinary trap. I mean, it just drew me in. I just wanted to be more like the bird than me. But it was lovely to hear that you said it was like horses as well. And in D.C. last night, I had a lovely man come over in the signing and say that my book was about international diplomacy, which made me so happy. I was like, really? He went, absolutely. So that was great. Sorry, the other part of the question was great. Was the
how much
she healed me, yeah.
Helped me to deal with the loss of my brother. And it's just something about, it was a little bit about what you're talking about, invisible, and I don't know, they just...
No, it's really interesting, the idea of animals as healing. I've been thinking about this a lot. I'm starting to think that animals let us become other selves, or they can speak for us and let us say things that we can't say when we're ourselves. Okay, that sounds... Here's a concrete example. I recently had a lovely chat with a psychotherapist. I hasten to add, not professionally. It was a conversation over a cup of coffee. And he said that he has a client who obviously, you know, he didn't tell me who she was, who brings a dog to all her sessions. She has great problems revealing her emotions, how she's feeling. So quite often in the sessions, she'll say, my dog's angry with you now. And I mean, everyone knows what's going on in that scenario, except the dog, obviously. But I think in a really brute way, that's what we all do with animals. They extend ourselves in ways that can be both enlightened and also very dark sometimes if you don't know quite what you're doing. So I'm allergic to horses, which is very sad. I live in Newmarket, which is Britain's home of racing, and I'm generally sneezing in the supermarket because there's so much horse dust around. I love them, but I can't get near them. Thank you. Sorry, I went on a bit there, but it's lovely. That's a lovely question.
Yeah, right here in the second row.
I always wanted to talk to an author.
Here I am, sir. Talk away.
A revelation occurred late in the book for me because as you were going through the book and training the goshawk, I was saying, why are you doing this?
Fair enough. Fair question.
Yeah, I mean, this is just really ridiculous. And other than your fine prose, until you admitted that you were going down the wrong path,
yeah.
I'm not going to say I didn't enjoy the book, but...
That's not something you need to need to say to me.
But yet that, to me, cleared it up. And
yeah.
Not a question here, I think, but your reading of your book, I think that's the way it should be read out loud.
Well,
I don't think
you.
I got the depth of it reading it myself.
Well, there is, it sounds like I'm doing a sales pitch here, but there's an audio book. I had this extraordinary experience. Well, actually, no, it was interesting. My publisher said, we're going to do an audiobook, and I said, can I read it? And my reasons for doing that were the sort of slightly pedantic worry that the person that read it would get the falconry terms wrong, or maybe the bird names wrong. You know, I'm this little tiny, passionate, fierce natural historian. That's not how that Latin name is pronounced. I hadn't really thought it through, really. Again, I went there, and I spent in this tiny studio in this wonderful little... It was great. They're called Isis Publishing, and the woman was like, we don't have any connection with them. That was an incredibly bad taste thing to say today. I'm deeply sorry. It's horrendous news from Brussels. But talking for 7 hours a day doesn't do good things for your throat. So I was having to drink raw honey, and I began to sound a bit like Lauren Bacall on 60 a day, and discovered how many common words I've routinely mispronounced all my life. That was quite sort of humiliating. And what was lovely about that experience was that outside, it was actually near a wholesale butcher's supermarket, and it was Christmas, so they had this man dressed as a snowman outside playing carols on a trumpet. And as the day went on, my voice would start to go, and he couldn't hold the tune. So we had this kind of bond going, me and the trumpeter, as the days went on. It was an amazing experience. So it is out there, and it's about sort of it's 1,000 hours of me just going on and on just like that. So thank you.
Yeah, right behind him.
There's a double dealing here with your grief. One is with the hawk, and one is with the writing. When did you know you had to write this? And what place did the writing itself play in this?
Really great question. I guess towards the end of that year, when I realized I'd come back from somewhere that wasn't, it was a very weird place, and I'd achieved some measure of being back in a place that was more like home, like a journey and a return, I realized there was a story there that was much bigger than me. It was a very old story. It had sort of a weird mythical feel to it. And I started to sort of feel, and I say this in the book a few times, that these old stories work through you. You know, they're much like the goshawk. They're more important than you are. And I wondered I didn't think it would be a book, but then years went past, and it took me about 5 years to realize that I wanted to write it as a book. And I think I needed that time to distance myself, not just from the emotion of that time, but from the person I had been. I think there are two kinds of books on grief. There are ones that are written right in the middle of that battlefield of horror, like the extraordinary Joan Didion book, The Year of Magical Thinking, which if you haven't read, is an astonishing work. And then there are those that are written much later. And I had to do it like that. I needed that woman in the book to be a character. But I remembered that year with crystalline clarity. And I think one of the things that grief does sometimes is bolt those memories in very, very fiercely. It took me 5 years to get around to writing it. And then I sold the book on proposal, which was exciting and terrifying. And then I had to write it. I didn't think the book would be grief work. I thought it was all done. And then the last day, I remember putting the final sentence in, and I felt sick. I felt very nauseated, and I felt like I was going to faint. And I realized that it really had been grief work. It had been a proper goodbye to my dad and to that person that I was back then. And the thing about grief, and anyone here who suffered a loss knows that you don't ever get over it. You just have to incorporate it in yourself and become a person that can have that grief inside you, and you carry it forever. But you need to make yourself into someone new, and that's what had to happen before I wrote it. That sounds terribly grand, doesn't it? But that was the story of the book.
A question that will probably take us into lighter territory than where you were just there. I'm curious what you make of what seems to me just this wider growing interest in birds. I'm thinking of two events that have been a part of the author series here that I would never have thought were attracted, and they were packed in both cases. A woman who wrote a book, I think, called The Unfeathered Bird. I'm not sure if you know her, but she's a Brit, I believe. And then a guy who did, Andy, what was it, The Field Guide?
David Sibley, he's a god. Right. My goodness. I was just talking about, when next time he comes back, I'm going to fly over,
Sure. So in both cases, the room was packed.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, the earlier reference to horses, is there something about birds, or are birds a vehicle for, I guess, so many of the emotions part of your book? Do other animals not lend themselves?
I think other animals are harder to see. I mean, to be really, mammals are kind of hard to spot. Certainly in England they are. I mean, mammals tend to come out at night and then they don't hang around. And I mean, the ones you do see are things like, rats. and they are this sort of wondrous set of very visible organisms that sing. I was talking to the artist Tony Fitzpatrick recently in Chicago, and he said, he was talking to hobos back in the day, and that was the only music they had, And it tied them to place in a way as well. And I think for me, what birds do is really interesting. Every time I see a bird in a particular place, it becomes about the place. Birds live in particular habitats, so if in England, if I see a wood warbler, it's in a leafy beechwood in spring. So those birds come to stand for places, like the way Aldo Leopold, the same sort of thing. He would talk about the noumenon of places being these animate objects that are birds. So I always think that birds mean more than just birds. They mean places, and they mean ecosystems and habitats and experiences. And the older you get, the more meaningful they become in that regard. And I think that at times of great economic and political uncertainty, there seems to be a sort of tendency for people to move towards nature or think about the natural world as some kind of refuge, just as I was saying. And I think one of the reasons maybe is not just that, but also, we are living in what's pretty much the sixth great extinction. It's, it's grim out there. So, let's try and love the things that we've got before they've gone. That sounds... You said it was going to be a lighter question. I don't know what happened there. But thank you. It's a really thought-provoking one. Thank you.
I'm fascinated by the relationships of people with wild animals and myself with birds and cats, which is problematic.
There's a bit of a conflict going on there, isn't there?
But I also live with someone who has an extraordinary ability to communicate telepathically with a lot of animals, including our pet cats. And, for example, the exchanges that go on are so specific and surprising. He was explaining to our cat that he was going to go to another country for a while, and he received the answer back, like, why would you go somewhere else to see people? Everything you need is right
here. Whoa, wow.
And he's extraordinary. Lots of exchanges like that are really mind-boggling to me.
I think it's really interesting. I have a parrot now. My friends tell me it's emotionally more healthy than a hawk. I tend to think that a lot of the... I mean, my view is that a lot of those unconscious communications that seem very, very clear are basically an animal that has an exquisite ability to read human moods and human gestures, and a person who can read the animal gestures. I mean, that's kind of how it works for me. But then, having said that, when I wake up in the morning, my parrot, as soon as I open my eyes, I can hear him say hello from the next room. So, I don't know. I think that... I heard a wonderful story recently, actually, about a chap who said that he went to visit his father, who has a cat, and the phone rang twice. And his dad said, oh, that'll be the cat coming home. And his son said, what? And at that moment, he said, go and open the door. And the son opened the door, and the cat came in. And his father let him stew on this for some time before he said that actually what happens is the cat goes to the next door neighbors and has dinner, and then when the cat leaves, the next door neighbor rings up. But I think, I mean, you know, there is more in heaven and earth than is dreamt of in our philosophy. So, I mean, if someone discovers some weird quantum thing that involves animals and humans communicating telepathically, I'd be very excited to find that was the case. Thank you.
Hi, this book was unlike anything I'd ever read before, and whereas it wasn't a happy book, I had lost my dad in 2011.
I'm sorry.
And but I've got a lot of closure with it. And one thing I noticed at the time was how my brother and my mother and I expressed our grief, bringing it way down again. And
it's important stuff.
And I think you're an only child, correct?
No, and this is something that people give me so much grief about. I completely understand. I really want to hear a question. Basically, I didn't write so much about my mother and my brother in the book because they're still alive, and we're very close, and I didn't want to intrude on their lives. So, you know, there was a lot of talking with them, a lot of phone calls, but they're just not in.
Right, so I have a brother and my mom, too, that he left behind. And were you cognizant of the time at the time, or were you just sort of in your space, understanding how they were reacting to this sudden loss?
Yeah.
Because what this book really, really speaks to me is the individuality of grief.
Yeah.
It's a process that's very, very individual as a snowflake. So
it is. And, you know, if it hadn't been a goshawk, I think it would have been inadvisable affairs, drinking, anything that would have just blotted out the person, you know, who I felt that I couldn't bear to be anymore. The hawk did that very well. But it is an individual thing. I mean, in the book I talk about how it's like, you know, someone comes into a room and punches everyone in the stomach. I mean, everyone's suffering the same pain, but you can't share it. And it's a very weird thing, grief, isn't it? Because it makes you very self-absorbed in a way that you really can't control. And I wanted to get across how self-absorbed I was in this book, with the result that many readers just think I'm a nightmare. You know, gosh, she's such a Prozac queen. She's just completely self-obsessed. That's what happened to me with grief. And I do wish now that I had. I mean, I think at the time I just knew that my mother and my brother were hurting, and we talked a lot about Dad on the phone, and we cried a lot, and we, you know. But I don't think it's possible to understand another person's grief. It's the same as yours, but it's 1,000 miles away. And that's one of the great agonies of it, is that you can't share it like that. I'm very sorry for your loss, Anne.
Just a couple of kind of associations. One is to when we lose someone, such as a parent, sometimes one way of coping with that is to create some new life and have a child. Just one thought. The other is has to do with empathy and the comments that people have been making about your ability to get inside the head of Mabel. And I guess it makes me think of a mother who is inside the head of her child and that kind of empathy. But it also makes me think of the hunter who gets into the head of the prey. And yeah. I think you were alluding to that with the anthropology description with the caribou. So anyway, I'm just kind of...
No, absolutely. Those mirror neurons are useful for all sorts of things, including babies and hunting.
Yeah. So.
And I like that you mentioned the hunting, because I think many people, you know, there's been a sort of discussion as to, you know, that there's a sort of a gendered aspect to this book. And one of the things that's been very interesting to me is I've had many, many letters from women who said, I read your book. It reminded me so much of being in a house with a new baby. You're in this house with something that doesn't speak. It's infinitely precious. You're terrified all the time. You're doing something very wrong. You're going to break it. And I hadn't expected that isolation to be one that chimed with the isolation of having a new child. So again, you know, it was a pattern. I mean, I didn't have a partner. I wasn't going to have a baby. I mean, that would have been a bit foolhardy of me, I think. Also, babies can't catch dinner for you when they're 12 weeks old. I'm being flippant. But I mean, I think there are ways in which we encounter the world that are constrained by all sorts of things. And I'm still very... I'm kind of thrilled by that comparison, yeah. I didn't think of Mabel as a baby, but I guess in some ways she was, yeah.
So my question is definitely more of the lighter side.
You just wait, though. You don't know what I'm going to say in return.
You mentioned earlier in your book that when you were little, you always wanted to be a hawk. So
yeah.
I wanted you to go a little more in detail, like what kind of hawk you wanted to be. And if today, what kind of hawk would you be now? Is that a different one? Talk a little about personality traits, perhaps.
This is a great question. I've never been asked this question. Okay, so back then I wanted to be a peregrine falcon because they were the best. All the books said so. They were the fastest. They were the most aristocratic. I mean, I talk about this sort of imperial kind of loading of falconry. There's an amazing book I read once, which was a falconry book explaining that you could fly these birds from Spain and from Portugal and from Greece, these other species. But they were kind of lackadaisical playboys. They didn't take anything seriously. And what you really wanted if you were a falconer was a good peregrine because they were hardworking and English. And I was like, right, that must be true. You know, it's absolutely horrendous. But they are really cool. And I know that, you know, there are a lot of urban peregrines in America now, and they're amazing birds to watch. So I wanted to be a peregrine. What would I like to be now? Oddly enough, I think a gerfalcon. They're very, very brainy, huge falcons that live in the Arctic. I mean, they're just basically like things made of duvets crossed with an eagle. And they're super, super brainy and super playful. And they do things like sort of, you know, lie on their backs in the snow and kind of... And much more... This is a bit like that Simpsons quiz, isn't it? Which Simpsons character are you? You know, tells you who you are. So, yeah, I think a gerfalcon now. Yeah, they're pretty awesome.
I'm pretty sure H is for Helen. Please join me in thanking
Helen
McDonald.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've had a lovely, lovely time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.